Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Has the American-Israeli war on Iran become a quagmire? As time passes, it certainly appears so. Trump has neither the time or clocks. Also, as Europe prepares for a war on Russia, Russia reevaluates its view of Europe, in particular, Germany. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we have Mark Sloboda. He is an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Well, let's start out with Mark here. Where do we stand in this war against Iran? Secretary of State Marco Rubio, I think in the last news cycle, emphatically said that the United States has all of the cards. But if the United States has all the cards, why isn't the Strait of Hormuz open?
Well, as the popular meme online has shown, Trump did a post with himself holding all the Uno cards and saying, "I have all the cards." Apparently not really understanding the rules of Uno, and to which the Iranians replied with, "We have less cards, Uno cards," which of course is the aim of winning the game of Uno, showing once again the foreign policy public diplomacy brilliance of the Trump administration. I'm not sure if it's a quagmire, depending on your definition of that, because largely the ceasefire between the U.S. and Israel and Iran has held. Lebanon is another story entirely, of course, apart from some small naval skirmishes. What we've done is we've entered a new phase of the war, and this is, you could call it dueling blockades. I like to think of it as geoeconomic chicken. The two testosterone-driven, hopped-up teenagers are in their speedsters, Iran in their economy, and the Trump administration, default stuck driving the global energy markets and the global economy, and they're both hurtling towards a precipice, right, or each other, depending on your reading of chicken. And whoever blinks first, whoever can endure the most damage on the route to mutual destruction will avert the car. And all the factors tell us, we had U.S. intelligence through Reuters telling us that Iran can outlast the U.S. blockade, right? So quite obviously, there is dissatisfaction within the U.S. intelligence services, and they're speaking out to the public about it. So Trump is getting desperate, and he's tried twice in the last week through various soft uses of military power, for the most part, to open the Strait of Hormuz. More of it was psychological and PR, and both of them failed. Both of them failed, and U.S. ships retreated from it. He's got to break out of the status quo, and the only way.
Well, he took the words right out of my mouth. The status quo, and I think that's what we started with last week, gentlemen, was a question on, is the status quo tenable, George? Well, I would, in looking at all of this here, and considering the failure of public diplomacy, as Mark has pointed out, do you believe that the Trump administration takes negotiations seriously, or are they actually trying to think of something else in lieu of this, we're waiting for the response on this and this, I don't believe that anymore. There's no reason for me to believe it. We've been down this road twice already. So the status quo is not tenable. We all agree on that. You could agree or disagree with me if the Trump administration takes diplomacy seriously. Israel certainly doesn't. So then, what's behind door number three? George?
Well, that's a good question. It's hard to know, because what the Trump administration really doesn't have too many good options. I mean, as Mark is right, I mean, they're doing the blockade. The blockade is not really working terribly effectively. It's not a foolproof blockade, but Iran obviously has the means at its disposal to prevail. And I think what the intelligence community, it's even and the media themselves reported, Iran has other means of getting goods out and getting goods in that other than through the Strait of Hormuz.
George, you're absolutely right, and I'm glad you point that out. However, is this strategy, and let's look at the big picture here, is this strategy going to see the end of sanctions? Is it going to see a new security arrangement in the Gulf? See, these are the ultimate goals. Survival, well, that's a goal for every power, large and small. You see what I'm getting at, okay? Go ahead.
No, it is, and that's why Trump, who obviously saw that the kinetic part of the war was not working for him, and it was leading to enormous casualties, disastrous consequences in the Gulf, he backed off from that and decided, well, we'll try this method. But it's clear that this method is even less likely to deliver the goods for him. So he is then faced with the option, okay, are you going to negotiate seriously? And there are, you know, sometimes it seems like, well, they're close to some kind of an agreement, or sometimes they're taking seriously.
Yeah, according to Bloomberg.
According to Bloomberg, and also to Barak Ravid of Axios.
Israeli intelligence.
That's right.
However,
what are the other options? The other options is, you know, if you go with the blockade, that isn't going to deliver anything. That's a long, long, long process, and it's very unlikely Trump has the patience to go ahead with it. Restart the war, that's unlikely to yield anything very much. So therefore, the only option really on is restart negotiations seriously, which means make serious concessions.
Yeah, okay. Well, so Mark, Iran has certainly not lost. I think we can agree on that. But which side is winning?
Simply by their respective goals at the start of the illegal, unprovoked U.S.-Israeli war of aggression on Iran. The U.S. and Israel made clear their ultimate goal was regime change. You know, they iterated various other things, which have also never been met. They've never destroyed Iran's ballistic missile program. They haven't got the nuclear dust, the nuclear enriched uranium, as Trump likes to call it. None of that has been accomplished. Meanwhile, because of the power imbalance, all Iran really had to do was survive, right? To keep their government and political and social system in power throughout and endure, you know, whatever the U.S. could dish out. And they've not only done that, but now they also have taken control of, and the U.S. has not been able to change that fact, the Strait of Hormuz, which gives them such a strategic advantage that we have the New York Times saying that they're the fourth great power in the world now. That is a huge disparity. Iran is winning. I think that is really unquestionable at this point. The problem, as the Russians have started to point out, is that the United States is not only negotiation incapable, they are diplomacy incapable. Right. The Iranians keep saying we're ready for serious negotiations. Serious negotiations does not mean Trump's slick real estate buddy and his son-in-law. Right. They're incompetent and incapable of conducting serious negotiations. So whether or not they are serious about talking, they're incapable of diplomacy.
George, how does the impending visit, if it actually goes through, of Trump going to Beijing, how much is this playing a role here? And maybe just in general, Iran is important for China, and China is important for Iran. What role are they playing here? Because I think that they're commerce-minded. They understand the dilemma that Iran is in. But, you know, they've got their own agenda as well. How is China playing in this?
Well, I think that China's playing a major role here because, after all, the Chinese are not stupid. They do know that this attempt on the part of the Trump administration, first off, to apply pressure on Venezuela and then to try to destroy Iran is about denying China its energy needs. So that it's clearly the Chinese know, yeah, this that ultimately China is the target here. And it obviously is the, you know, the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy, not just Trump's, but it was the clear early Biden's policy as well, and will be the next administration. So China, but you'd have to then think in terms that is Trump likely to relaunch the kinetic part of the war while he's in Beijing? I have to think that that's very unlikely. He's not going to, because there could be all sorts of embarrassing developments during that, you know, that phase of the war. He doesn't want to be in a position talking to Xi Jinping while there are all kinds of embarrassing news items that he, Trump, has to respond to. So one has to think that at least during the next week or so, there won't be the relaunch of the war.
What do you think about that, Mark? Because my long-held contention is that what will ultimately force some kind of outcome, and I don't know what that would be, it's going to be the global economy. That's okay. Going to force it.
Yeah, and the global economy is not doing well. Asia has already been the most affected by this crisis, particularly U.S. allies, South Korea and Japan, because they were the most heavily dependent on energy, both oil and LNG, from the Strait of Hormuz. So, both countries are on energy rationing at this point. They're asking drivers to not drive on certain days, depending on which number their license plate ends on. I mean, that's the situation that they're in. And that pain is expected to hit Europe within the next 2 weeks to a month. Of course, that is more U.S. allies. So we see U.S. allies. And that's to say nothing of the developing world, right? The global South, where... let's be brutal and frank. The consequences of all of this is that millions of people are going to starve to death, or are going to face malnutrition and starve to death, because the price of fertilizer has gone so high that farmers are forced to buy less fertilizer or not use fertilizer at all. And 4 billion people on this 8 billion people planet survive on that razor edge between fertilizer that is amazingly enough produced from dead dinosaurs and vegetation, right? Hydrocarbons. Very scary when you think about it. But there is a food energy nexus that a lot of people are not understanding that is a terrible consequence. Whether or not Trump cares about those 4 billion people, there is going to increasingly be pressure, at least from U.S. allies, on.
Well, I think something. The global opinion will be this is what Trump brought about with an illegal war. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lovell. To remind you, we're discussing some real news. And George, that real news is Victory Day in Russia, which is celebrated on May 9th, has come and gone. Festivities that were not as on par as we've seen in the past, but they were there nonetheless. What's really interesting, and we both, all three of us here, think about Victory Day as a very important day in Russia and in history. And it has ended up being a point of contention of how to interpret the past and how to move forward. And we have, and you, George, and I have talked about it at great length, the remilitarization of Europe, Germany first and foremost in this process here. But the Russians are also reevaluating how they see Europe. We have Dmitry Trenin, which we all know, recently said, today Russia is at war again, and this is not simply between Russia and Ukraine. And he's absolutely right, George.
No, he is absolutely right. And it's clear from all of the pronouncements of the European leaders, NATO leaders, and particularly the policies that are being pursued in Germany, but in a number of other countries, that the Europeans are preparing for war with Russia sometime around 2029, 2030. Now, whether that comes about or not, for the Russians, they have to realize that this is on the cards. The calculation seems to be that they're going to keep the Ukraine war going until then, and that by then, which means Russia will have been at war for 8 solid years, Russia will be so weakened that it'll be easy pickings for NATO.
That's the theory.
That's the theory. That's the theory. But I think if, you know, the Russian leaders have to take that seriously. So that's obviously the strategy that the Europeans are going with, and in particular with Germany, because Germany is now openly saying, first of all, that we're effectively at war with Russia. We have to prepare for this war with Russia, and we intend to be the strongest army in Europe. And we take responsibility for the whole of Europe. So that was that we are dividing.
I've heard that somewhere.
That's right, yes. Global responsibilities are to be divided up. United States will focus on China and the Far East, and of course on the Southern Hemisphere. And when it comes to the European continent, this will be in the within the purview of a German-led Europe. So that's obviously the plan. And the, I mean, we saw this on this VE Day when people in Germany were being arrested for showing the Russian flag or the Soviet flag. They were being arrested, and you had Friedrich Merz, who refused to say who exactly liberated Germany. He actually refused to actually say who it was. So the revisionism of history of World War II, it accompanies this militarization of the European continent.
Okay, well, using that logic, I'll go to Mark right now. Then the Second World War in Europe is not over. It's just been paused for 81 years.
I mean, that would be a tremendous disservice to the millions of Soviet citizens, of course, who died in World War II, if that were indeed the legacy of their victory over Nazi Germany and its European fascist allies. I would say that it did end, but it has come back from the dead. Right. That is, we're going through a period of resuscitation. And in large part, that's been brought about because of the Western embrace of a Banderite fascist regime in Ukraine. And I believe that that has actually had a corrupting influence on.
Yeah, I've called it Europeanization of Ukraine, but the Ukrainian.
The Ukrainization of Europe. Yes, absolutely. Here's the problem is I don't believe any of it. I mean, I believe that's their plan, but I don't believe they're capable of implementing it. Chancellor Merz is the most unpopular chancellor in modern German history. I don't believe that his policies are going.
Well, probably the second most unpopular.
Second most popular. Okay. I mean, modern. That's right. I said. Okay. Yeah. Germany, their military is in a sorry state. As the British and the French, to think that they're going to convert their automobile factories to produce weapons, that actually isn't a real thing in the modern world. It doesn't work that way with modern weapons and technology. And the energy costs now that they're paying, you have to have energy to build weapons. Plus, their people don't want to serve in their militaries. They're already starting fining people for avoiding registering with their military. military. And the British and the French have the same problem. There was just a report out this week that the British, through all of their smack talking, and they do a lot of smack talking at Russia, they won't be able to afford new weapons until 2030. So I know.
Well, and also they've had to cut the number of ships in their navy because they can't find people.
Yeah, don't have enough people to man them. Yeah. So I don't believe any of this. I believe might have the delusion, but they cannot implement it.
I know where you're coming from here, but and this is something that George and I have talked about extensively here. I see this as some kind of unifying principle to generate consensus within the European political elite to keep the European project moving forward. Russia is a very convenient boogeyman, as they say, and it's just a unifying principle because it's easy to push Russophobia. I mean, everything that goes wrong in Europe, if there's an energy crisis, the far right or the far left wins, it's Russia's fault. It's Russia's fault at everything, and it's very, very convenient. But it's very dangerous too. Okay,
I would take the opposite. I think the Russophobia is the real part, and it's driving the pretense at European unity rather than the other way around in terms of.
But George, Russia cannot ignore these statements coming out of European capitals about deeming Russia as the enemy and they must prepare for war. Russia has to take that seriously because, well, on Victory Day, we celebrated the victory of the collective West against the Soviet Union. And the collective West was run by Nazi Germany at the time, or at least European-wise. So, I mean, you know, the Russians have to take this seriously. I get Mark's point about, you know, rejigging your entire economy and all of that. But then that we've seen with in the Ukraine war and what's going on in Iran, drones and missiles and whatnot are very effective as well. George.
Yes, they are effective. And you absolutely have to take them seriously because over the past 4 years, step by step, the Europeans have let go many of their restraints. They've taken risk after risk after risk that they would never have taken just a few years ago. So they're involved in launching missiles deep into Russian territory, killing Russians. Something that would have been unheard of, you know, back in the days in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s. No, we don't want to ever mess with these people. We don't want to risk a nuclear war. They've taken risk after risk. So there's no reason to assume that they're not going to do so. And the calculation is they're going to do it in a few years' time. So it's all the thinking, look, Russia will be severely weakened by then. We will be in a much stronger position. This will be our historic opportunity. Now, where will they find the manpower? Well, there's a lot of migrants around in Europe. These migrants.
You want to arm them. They want to arm them. Okay.
You provide the incentives. The incentives, okay. military service in exchange for legalization of your status. You know, you want European citizenship, you want to stay here in the EU, do you want to get you want to get deported? If you want to stay here in the EU, you serve in the military. So that's just one way where they're going to find.
I guess that's a 21st century serfdom here. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, so second problem with all of this is the Russian military is not getting weaker, right? It's getting stronger. It's getting considerably stronger, both in size, in the quantity of weapons and munitions and missiles, in the quality of them, and in battlefield experience and tactics. Russian military, the New York Times trumpeted, the New York Times, not me, that Russia is building a future war machine while the U.S., much less the Europeans, is antiquated and incapable of either the production or the military tactics. That should tell us something. Secondly, the Russians are taking this seriously because the Russian former president and prime minister, still the deputy chair of the National Security Council, Dmitry Medvedev, you want to call him the bad cop, you want to call him Putin's anger management translator, that's fine. He wrote a very lengthy piece in RT this week that boiled down to, just angrily talking about this attempt at the remilitarization of Germany, and that Russia is going to have to stop negotiating and trying to reason with the Europeans and instill an animal fear in them in order to convince them that they should never even fantasize like they're doing now about war with Russia. And that tends to make me think that they're thinking about a deterrence demonstration.
Yeah, this is, again, something that we've been talking about for a number of years, and it's always been under the rubric of explaining Russia's restraint. But looking at some of the foreign policy thinkers in Russia, people tend to focus on the Western ones, George, but then there's quite a few here in Russia, and they're getting a lot more muscular, I would say, in how to approach the West crossing Russia's red lines. And we're always like, why do they allow that to happen? I see this changing. I see there's a rethinking here, because obviously the West does not want to negotiate. It seems incapable now. And so you have to go to the next level or a different dimension. Go ahead, George.
No, I think that's right. And I think particularly the foreign policy thinker that you're referring to is Sergei Karaganov. And he has been writing for some time suggesting that Russia really does have to think about using nuclear weapons, because it was nuclear weapons that in the past had acted as a restraint on the West. Well, hey, we don't want to start a nuclear war. But then the West had figured out, and they said it openly, well, the nuclear weapons, Russia's not going to use nuclear weapons for the obvious reason that if they use nuclear weapons, we're going to use nuclear weapons. Therefore, it'll be just, you know, as mutual annihilation. Therefore, nuclear weapons are really no deterrence whatsoever, because we know they're not going to use it. We're not going to use this. So therefore, and that's what Karaganov is getting at. Well, since they've lost their fear of us, because they think that we're never going to use nuclear weapons, we have to think in those terms that, yeah, whether it's through...
All right, gentlemen, I see Mark really wants to respond, but this is broadcast television, not a podcast, and we have to wrap it up. I want to thank my guests in Moscow and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RDC. And excellent, remember, cross that rules.